Welcome back to today's WISCAPE Forum on Funding and Accountability in Public Higher Education. I'm Noel Radomski, the Managing Director of WISCAPE. In this morning's sessions, Professor Trostel and Ed St. John helped us explore questions around the return to the state's investment in higher education and the wisest way to make this investment. These presentations provided an excellent start to today's conversation. As I mentioned this morning, we'll have a host of information from today's event, including policy briefs, working papers, and copies of the PowerPoints available on our website, I hope next week, definitely next week. We also will have MP3 files of each of the four presentations as well. We'd also like to be able to contact you with information about future WISCAPE programs and WISCAPE research and translated activities. If you'd like to receive announcements from us, please leave us your business card at the table in the lobby. With that in mind, should we get started? All right. To begin our afternoon session, I'm very pleased to introduce Professor David Wirtz. David J. Wirtz is an assistant professor of higher education in the Department of Educational Leadership at Florida Atlantic University, and I'm glad to say he's a faculty affiliate at WISCAPE. His teaching and scholarly interests include state financing of higher education, university community engagement, and alumni philanthropy and volunteerism. His research has been published in various scholarly outlets, including the Journal of Higher Education, New Directions for Institutional Research, and forthcoming issue of Research in Higher Education. Professor Wirtz has 9 years of experience in university advancement and has held major gifts officer positions at the University of Wisconsin Foundation and the University of Minnesota Foundation. His scholarly work has been supported by the Spencer Foundation and the National Forum on Higher Education for the Public Good at the University of Michigan. Professor Wirtz holds a PhD in higher education from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we are very pleased to have David back on our campus once again. His presentation today is entitled, What Determines Levels of State Support for Higher Education? 20 Years of Evidence. Please join me in welcoming David Wirtz. David?
Well, thank you. Does this work? You can hear? Well, I'm thrilled to be back in my home state, especially since when I landed it was 85 degrees and now, 45? So I'm like, feels like at home. I remember these days, and how much can you really pack, you know, in a couple of days to really know what you're going to get into? But I just want to start out by saying thanks to WISCAPE, particularly Noel, Nick, and Beth for their help with coordinating this and also supporting this project. It's been really fantastic, and I'm grateful to be a part of this and WISCAPE affiliate. I also want to acknowledge my colleague, Justin Ronka, as you see from the screen. Justin is a doctoral student in statistics and a WISCAPE graduate student and assistant, and he's great. He's actually taking a statistics exam right now, which, as I told him yesterday, statistics exam, root canal, you know. So he had that to do today. So I want to acknowledge him and quickly say about him, we tease him because he's in and out of things, but Justin is one of these guys, when I think about, you know, the beauty of Wisconsin and how much they care about their discipline. When I first moved to Florida, as you know, it gets a little windy down there a certain time of year with hurricanes, and he called me and said, hey, I was just kind of tooling around, you know, the national data set for the Hurricane Center the other night, and I ran all the quadrants, and I think it's going to go north of you this next hurricane. So in addition to being a fine scholar, you know, I have a National Weather Service support with Justin. So we're thrilled to have him support that, and I want to acknowledge his great support in this project. Well, the topic for today is to look at this idea, 20 years of state support for higher education. I want to acknowledge an interesting and a very well-written book of history by John Thielen at Kentucky, when he really documents looking at the past 30 years of higher education, and he calls higher education a troubled giant. And so one of the things he kind of talks about in that context is higher education's golden age ending with questions about large public investment. I remember Jay Stampin many years ago telling me that, boy, I didn't want to leave graduate school because I was maybe making more money in college than I would when I get the job. I remember saying that. So, and the idea is that, and Ed St. John and others have put this book together, is looking at the rationales for funding public higher education has changed. And Thielen's piece is that this has been sort of an overbuilt system with many promises that maybe haven't been made. And as part of that is looking at these shifting political winds in the 1980s. And I'm just using this to kind of set context for the describing this particular study. But this idea of a new federalism, of a more of a conservative movement, anti-tax, state responsibility, fueled a national desire for tax cuts and also increased state pressures, according to Hovey and others, for these other areas within a state budget. So that's a little bit of the context of that. So people would argue, based on this 20-year of history, that there's this idea of the unraveling state-university partnership. One of the things I would like to reference Robert Tekushian, who's at Indiana. He just put together an interesting paper where he added some clarity of saying when we talk about declining state support, it's important to say it's the relative level, in other words, the amount that the demand and the increase that states are able to support higher education versus the actual levels. Because Thielen argues that, well, you know, if you look at really support has gone up in dollars every year, but it's the capacity of states to support the new demand. So I think that's a helpful way to think about that. But present trends continued. We had a number of authors, King Alexander, I know, contributed to this recent book called What's Happening to Public Higher Education, that talked about some of these consequences, including rising tuition, enrollments, financial aid cuts, and that sort of piece as well. Also, another recent from some local folks here as well, Lyle and Sell, have talked about this trend as the de facto privatization of higher education. So this provides us a little context to talk about how I'm kind of getting involved with my particular study. So when we think about this 20-year context, if we ask some foundational questions that helps us sort of unpack what are these factors that are maybe leading to decreasing state support, or who's doing better in terms of these different factors, it leads us to ask some questions, including what really matters most. We're going to talk about kind of a framework to think about that. There's a lot of things that can happen in a particular state and institution itself. We want to know what matters most in determining these levels. Second question is, to what extent do these factors, are they more state-related, or do the institutions themselves have some kind of factor in terms of their own fate and receipt of state appropriations? So we want to kind of look at that. And also, thinking about forging an agenda forward is, can we do research on finding out, relative to all of these things, are there some institutions that are doing better than others in terms of their state support based on what you'd predict that they would receive? So the research questions guiding this particular study that that Justin and I are working on are as follows. Following out that, we looked at data from 1985 to look at factors that explains these differences in levels of support for institutions. And we really look at these through the lens of the Carnegie commission, or the Carnegie ranking or categorization, classification of how research institutions, comprehensible universities, and community colleges may fit into this whole landscape of state support. And the third one is keeping in context with the Carnegie classified institutions. What can we say about those that have historically received more or less support? So those are the questions guiding this study and our kind of discussion for today. And one of the things that, you know, I wanted to do is to look at a new theoretical framework that would help us think about these questions. We've had some really excellent, I think, studies in this area through economics lenses, other political science. I wanted to look at this through a sociology of organizations perspective, so it's kind of another way to think about this. So this builds on some of my past work. on this. Some of the limitations of my past work on this is it only looked at a snapshot in time of these issues during the late 90s. And the other thing that was a limitation is I only, prior with this study, 2002, looked at research universities. Well, now we're kind of expanding this to look at all of these Carnegie classification institutions. So from my review in the literature, put together the idea that these forces at work that really explain these differences are the product of rational forces. So these are kind of data-driven, optimal, rational decisions to support higher education. These are political, so they're power-driven, all the way from the governor down to the campus. Or third, this cultural factor is values and symbols-driven, history, tradition, and purposes. And how we understand that at various state levels and institutional levels is the framework that I've been working on and will continue to, which I'll mention in a little bit. So these rational factors, state-level factors, we draw on some classic organizational theory literature saying that this is really based on an objective review of data of what you kind of need in your state and what you have. And that really centers on availability of revenue. So it's the idea if your state doesn't have a lot of money, a discretionary program like higher education isn't going to do very well. One of the things I think is interesting is that King Alexander had a paper a few years ago, I believe it was at Cornell, where he looked at, maybe King can help me out with this, but it was the idea that you had some states that actually were more wealthy, but they were actually giving less effort than the poorer states. So that's another interesting question to look at. But in general, it's the idea if you have more money, you're able to support an institution like higher education. Another rational factor is to consider the demand and the composition of people in your state, the type of residents. So we know that states use and institutions use demographic data to make sort of ploys for more support. For example, if you have a lot of college-aged, traditional-aged residents, 18 through 24, you can make rational arguments about why it's important to invest in this population. Now, the percentage of population over 65, like where I live in Boca Raton, we have a lot of happy hour, the 4 o'clock, the early bird specials, very nice folks who live in the neighborhood. They maybe have less interest in supporting higher education because they have other needs via healthcare, other services. So you can see that composition, and that relates to cultural issues, which we'll talk about later as well. And the other piece of it, when we look at the institutional levels, there are some rational factors or support strategies that institutions might consider. For example, competitive strategy from Child talks about that leaders choose these optimum strategies to compete with other resource-dependent entities given regulators, competitors, and barriers. Well, what does that mean? Well, the way I look at this is there are some competitive strategies that institutions use. One of it we heard about from Phil Trostel, linking to economic development, improving tax capacity. So the idea of Hines talked about in 1988 that those institutions that were getting more money than you'd expect for higher education in the 80s explicitly linked their work to building tax capacity in their state. So this was a rational strategic measure that they used to do that. Another strategy, although it's mixed effects here, is there's increase in enrollment. So the idea, this is kind of a Florida thing too, is let's get these people in here, we'll get more money and support. However, some of this earlier work by Leslie and Ramey said, well, that's sort of marginal increase of what you get, because other authors have said that you might get a little bump in increase, but you're not fully subsidizing every student. So it's the idea that even though this is one strategy, it may not kind of trump them all. A third part, and this is kind of interesting, is thinking about Carnegie class, as we mentioned. Now, Carnegie class, as I mentioned, are those classifications of how to think about institutions in terms of research and their mission. And there's two ways to think about this. You could say, well, there's more money that's going to go to support the research missions because they cost more to operate, facilities, faculty are more expensive, so more support. Another way to think about it that Rizzo and other authors from Cornell have talked about is that, well, this is actually maybe the other way that legislators would see it as a better deal to give their money to community colleges because they're open access, they're more efficient in the sense of being able to offer more education, and they're cheaper in that way. So we're going to kind of talk about that and where that fits later on. This, I think, is kind of a fascinating piece, which in the future I'd like to investigate more, and the idea of fundraising. In the state of Florida, where I'm at, it's kind of a neat thing where they have a matching grant opportunity. So if you make a gift, and if you want to make a gift out to our department, we would appreciate that, and you will get a state match for supporting Florida Atlantic University. It's an innovative, important program that's helpful, so there's a real rational reason why we would go out, and that leverages state support. Now, this may have opposite effect than intended, and what this author found, Rizzo, was that it was actually more of a, in some places, a replacement effect for state dollars. In fact, this very room, Granger Hall, I remember when I was a new director of development at the graduate school at the UW Foundation, I remember somebody describing to me the Granger effect. Does anybody remember what that is? And the Granger effect was Granger Hall, right here, was that David Granger, I believe, made a gift of, was it $8 million, somewhere in that vicinity. Everybody was thrilled about it, and the state legislature said, isn't that great that you have such generous graduates? Let's have everybody else fund the building so we don't really need to step in. So it's the idea of a replacement idea. So we're going to kind of test this to see to what extent this might be on the positive side or the negative side of the ledger. Political factors at the state level. There's your politician out here waving his hand. It's this idea of strategic contingency. So what you have is organizations that are determined by these powerful actors looking at the state level. So these might be governors, legislators, system leaders. And there's a lot of evidence that says, well, this might be by party. So what you have is saying that Democrats are probably more typically going to fund higher education because they support public ventures and agencies better than Republicans generally. But as Jay Stampin and Reeves would say, this is not necessarily the case in the sense that his study of policy outcomes said that it's hard to distinguish maybe between a Republican in Georgia or a Democrat in Georgia and a Democrat in Minnesota. So it's to say that these regional differences might kind of mitigate what party means. Now, that may have changed over time based on some of Jay's recent research. But the other thing I think is funny about this, when you think about measuring these variables, and as economists like to say, I know it may be in the room, says, if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist, right? So, but what I think is interesting is when they talk about, you know, even just what's happening in the state of Wisconsin and the personal values that people have or even eccentricities. One of my favorite stories, there was a gentleman from North Carolina who was talking about his legislator in Western Carolina that he went to visit, and they were cultivating some of this work with the state budget. And he said, yeah, this guy was a brilliant guy. You know, he lived out there, really smart, well-educated and all this stuff. And he was very eccentric in the sense that I went there and, you know, I realized, and he knew this, that he was both a veterinarian and a taxidermist, in Western North Carolina. So he shows up to his door and he said he came out and he looked at this and there was a sign above his door that said, either way, you'll get your dog back. So what I'm saying is, I don't know, Lee Hansen, how do we measure these types of eccentricities which you have? So that's it's to say that these are messy ideas and theories and variables, and how you quantify human behavior is something to think about. Now, political variables can also be seen in other ways as well in terms of resource dependency. So what you might have is that this resource dependency theory sort of moves the strategic contingency down to the organizational level. So instead of the power actors, it's the power agencies that you're battling with in terms of higher ed. So what you have, K through 12 education, healthcare, corrections, there's a wealth of evidence that say those have been competing forces in states. And also the governance structure. One of the things that Justin and I found, and Lowry as well, is that I have here the UW system and the Florida Board of Governors. Well, what we found is that places like the UW system are very helpful in the sense that you don't have end runs, maybe to the degree you might have some, but you have more of a unified front for supporting higher education than, for example, Florida, where I'm at. I mean, in addition to everybody trying to be the best football team, everybody's going after a medical school, everything else, a law school. So the idea is that this competitive nature actually does worse for everybody loses in that situation. So that's what we found. Other studies have not found that, but we're still kind of working on that. Other political factors at the institutional level relate, again, strategic contingency, campus level. Our campus president at Florida Atlantic University was the former lieutenant governor of the state of Florida. He is a very close friend with the Bush family, Jeb Bush, and I can tell you, it helps a lot to have that in terms of opportunities for the institution, but it's this idea of a powerful actor that supports the institution. Another way of thinking about that is coalition building, and Noel and I talked about this the other night, of having subsets of, for example, people from the business community, community partnerships. Virginia was successful for a stretch in there with their higher ed business council, that they were able to elect pro-higher education leaders, make some tax or some incentives to support higher education. So in other words, there are all these things politically within the lobbyists and others can put together to support education. Now the other thing is last piece, which is very difficult to get your arms around, but I think it's fascinating, is this idea of the cultural factors. And these are far less studied, I think, in this whole field of literature, and is an area which I'll talk about a little bit more. But anybody recognize that picture over there? Who that might be? Mr. Van Heist, Madison Roots coming back here. But the idea is that decisions are driven by assumptions of how things should be. So the idea is if a state has historically cared a lot about higher education, like this state, because you could argue from progressive era, that there's sort of a continuance of this culture of feeling that, you know, this is what we care about. We're going to continue to increase support for education because that's who we're all about. Now, there's evidence that this can really differ by regions. One of the pieces from a prior study that I did was looking at, for example, Ohio, that has a very strong industrial, the rubber mill factories, and there's a feeling there, it's like, you know what, people can still make a lot of money going into the industry and the rubber mills. Higher education is not as important here because we have this other industry that allows us to do this. Now the other piece here is thinking about, for example, reliance on private higher education. So this is one of the factors that Lysel and Lydon, who wrote this piece in the 90s, said that this was really important because if you are a legislator in, for example, Massachusetts, and you have a private school in everybody's backyard, you feel less pressure as a legislator to support public higher education because you have a culture of private schools. So these are all these things that are, we try to measure these. I'll talk in a little bit. Also, cultural factors at the state level relate to this idea of obligatory action so that the state will treat higher education appropriately in exchange for being treated appropriately. One of the things that we learned in this short study in the 90s was that institutions that were perceived as being more engaged with their communities, for example, Georgia came out where I interviewed one legislator in Georgia, and he said, you know what, I'm down here in the shrimping industry in Savannah, and if I tried to pull money from the university system, I would hear about it from all of these fishermen. None of them ever been to Athens or the university, but all these guys from Extension are marching in with their little bulldog on their shirt, and they see them as a sort of seamless public good to supporting that institution. And it was fascinating because when I looked at Wisconsin, some of the implications are that it sort of hurt the UW-Madison campus that Extension is its own player. So the idea is they might not be getting the credit as with the, maybe have everybody put a badger on, but you know, Extension is different. So there's some implications there about service to the state. The other thing is in terms of these actions can also be cuts in support as punishment. I won't say too much of that. I read the papers here, what's going on here, you know, online from, you know, sunny Florida. So I don't need to say much more about that. But one of the interesting things is I was reading that obligatory action in Colorado was there was a lot of people saying, well, you know what, if Ward Churchill gets a raise in this state, there's room to cut the fat across the board. Okay, so these are symbolic actions that might have some kind of impact. Finally, the last thing that I will say about these cultural factors is the idea of institutional theory. And what this is all about is that these formal structures have meaning and importance regardless of whether they affect behaviors. Now, what does that mean? Basically, what the authors are talking about is that there might be some symbolic significance to a particular program or a campus that may have nothing to do with if they're actually doing anything or not, that people will support the institution. So you could argue that, well, oh, we have to support the land-grant university because they're the land-grant university. You know, this is the people of the state, you know, we support. The other part of it, which I think is very interesting, is one of the areas that Noel mentioned as I do research on public engagement. And we think about to what extent are these community engagement agendas really more institutional theory instead of saying, hey, we do community engagement. We got an office right over there. Well, it's not funded yet, but we got a thing on the door. It says community engagement. So to what extent are they used to kind of make a case for the institution versus whether they're really actually having any outcomes. So I think it's an interesting thing to look at. So so if we look at overall, and I know this is kind of harder to see from this framework, these would be the drivers of state support for higher education. And here's the overall theory. And I know I violated every rule of PowerPoint at this point, right? That you're not supposed to put more, what is it, 36 font or something? I don't know what it is. But the idea is that you have these choices that are rational, these are political, and these are cultural. So the idea is, when I kind of do my research in this area, is that looking at these are really state-level and institution-level variables. One of the things I told Noel is this talk is really a first part of one of two parts.
We'll hear about you in the winter time.
That's right. So I'm fishing for another opportunity to come back to do part two. So what I'm going to kind of introduce here is some data against this framework that would help us to understand variable what really matters the most. So some of our methodology that we use is using a time series model where we nest this data within states and in institutions. So we have this lag over a 25-year period, and we measure those different effects looking at these various covariates that I've identified from this conceptual framework that we could actually quantify. You'll notice that we couldn't get everything, but that's part two, we're working on that. And then also this other piece is looking at partitioning this residual variance, which really allows us to say, what's the goodness of fit of this model in terms of helping us understand kind of reduce the variance of what it explained and what it did not. So what that allows us to do is inform future research and say, there's some of these places that were well fit by this model and others were not. So that's going to be kind of the second part. So some of the data sources we use, and I say this at the end, but I don't want to forget to thank Effendi, Catherine Clark, and some others who are students at Wiscape who helped assemble this database. It was extensive. Also, David Tanberg at Penn State University shared some of his data with us. But we have these various units of analysis. We're really looking at these all degree-granting public institutions in the U.S. That have these levels. I'll let you read that enroll grad undergrads. Data is available, which was tricky in spots. And institutions that meet this criteria, as you see there, 1053 are all included in our database. So we looked at eventually, we started with 43, but came down and then to really analyze 21 variables over this period of time to analyze what these factors were most important. And the way that we kind of categorized, because we wanted to do it, remember the second question has to do by these classes. What we did is I looked at the Carnegie classification from 2002. So our first variable was looking at community type colleges, two, the regional comprehensives, and three. So it was able to give us kind of an apples to apples comparison. It's very difficult. In fact, anybody use the latest Carnegie class for doing? I see. You know, it's kind of funny. I shouldn't say this, you know, at the Carnegie people, I have this mic on, but one of the things that's challenging about it is there are so many categories now that they have with the new listing. So I think Florida Atlantic is research in university by the beach. No, I don't know if it's that. But, you know, so there's how many of us? Well, maybe, hey, Long Beach, you guys are right. So you'd be in the group. No, but I facetious a little bit with that. But so it's very difficult. There's very good reasons for why they changed this up. And they're compelling reasons, but it does make some things kind of difficult. So anyway, long story short, we used the older classification system, okay? So we had all these expected relationships based on what we read in the literature and from this theoretical organizational theory framework, okay? So that we thought, okay, that rational factors, state-level economic, that with increases in per capita income that you would be likely to receive more support. Likewise, if the unemployment rate went up, that your support would go down. Remember, these are optimal data things. Total state revenues would be correlated with increases. We looked at these demographic variables. So we thought that given the competition with K-12 and other areas, that percentage of state population that was more K-12 would have a negative effect on support for higher education. On the other end, that as a percentage went up of college-aged residents, not traditional, that there would be increase. Again, these are rational demands for doing that. And then also as a population over 65 increases, that higher education kind of falls off. So this is what we expected. The other variables in terms of rational perspective is that this was kind of mixed here, but I put it on this slide, is that based on some recent research that the community colleges might do better than the research ones for the reasons I explained in terms of their open access, they're seen as more efficient. Total private gifts, again, we say the Granger effect, another, we wanted to test that. We weren't exactly sure based on that. Also, this other idea of graduate enrollment, so this rational idea of increasing FTE we looked at. As far as political variables, we went back and looked at the party of the governor, since we, and I'd like to find, for those of you who have read Jay Stampin's famous work about the boll weevils, the honeybees, we want to use that to think about different coalitions of legislators to support higher education. But however, right now a limit is we've kind of been black and white in the sense of Republican, Democrat, okay? So we looked at that and we expect, based on some of that prior literature, that if you had majority of Republicans in both the House in the Senate, that you might have less support based on this literature. And political, in terms of state level, is that you see all these minuses here. We say that if there were all these competing factors, one of the things I didn't really talk about in the literature is this K-12 court reform. So those of you who follow that, Mike Rizzo, who was at Cornell, he found that this was an important variable so that if you had court-mandated reform of K-12 in your state based on finance, property tax, these types of things, that these were dramatic decreases for higher education. The other thing is a number of flagship type institutions. I owe this idea to Jim Hearn, who is a professor at Vanderbilt, and he talks about that, about the ecology of higher education in a state. So the idea is if you have a number of competing like flagship type of institutions in the state, that those other flagships would do well. An example of that is when I was at Minnesota, University of Minnesota Twin Cities is, I would say, the undisputed flagship, right, in Minnesota, whereas possibly in Indiana, you would have Purdue and Indiana go head-to-head, right? I mean, so it's the idea that these competing dependencies. So we kind of looked at that as well, almost through here. And then the cultural perspective, this is challenging, but this is where the future work is headed, is that we predicted that, again, this idea of private college enrollment, if you had a high percentage, that you'd receive less state support. If you had a higher two-year college enrollment, it would be a plus, again, for a community college. Voter participation has to do with kind of a measure of progressiveness and civic engagement. So we looked at this from other literature that presidential voter participation, if it were to go up, would be correlated with more support. So, and then finally, some of these you could see could fit in other frames too. This one I struggle a little bit. A number of public institutions in the state. The idea being is if you have historically supported higher education across the board with a number of institutions, you're going to continue to do that. And then finally, this idea of land grant status. So we thought that those institutions that had that status symbolically might receive more support because of who they are. So that's kind of the whole piece of the framework and how we thought about. So what did we learn from this? From the state level, certainly these ideas of rational measures were expected. That those places that had high unemployment rate, that in fact was the most, that was the strongest correlation in the whole project, is that unemployment rate was directly correlated to this. And I think what's interesting is what we heard from Phil Trostel today. I think there's very good argument for we look at this investment as a way to, I remember what you said, supply creates demand in terms of students in the past. So thinking about this as a rational perspective that this wealth really matters. And this was a very interesting finding here. Remember, we theorized that if you had a lot of 18 to 24-year-olds, the state might use that to say we need to invest. Well, actually, what ended up happening was the opposite. So what happened is that it was associated with decreased support for. And the reason we think about that, talking to Justin, is we think it has to do with tax capacity, right? Because when you think about it, if you have a high level of people who are 18 to 24, they're usually doing one of two things. They're one, in college, being supported by the state, or two, not in college and probably not making a lot of money and not helping the state with their tax capacity. So we think that that might be a proxy variable for thinking about state wealth in that sense, and I'd be curious what others would think about that. Go ahead. Not voting? Okay. Okay. Save that for our new find. So this was very interesting to us how we thought it kind of flipped in that sense. Other things from the rational perspective is at the Carnegie level. Remember, we thought you had kind of competing theories about where these institutions would sit. What we found is the way that we did this analysis is that there was the least volatility for these associate colleges and most for the master's and research universities. So when we looked at that in terms of changes in from year to year, is that they were more likely to have a stable flow of support compared to all the way to the other end, the research universities, who were the first to get cut and to have the most volatility over time. And we feel that this may rely on this Rizzo's work again, is that they might be favored to this open access, inexpensive instruction, independence on resources, because a place like UW-Madison can really raise its own money, can't it? We know that from the UW Foundation. They might have more capacity to do that and be seen as more independent so that they can go out to do that. So that was one of the findings from there. The other thing, I thought this was very interesting, and I found a good quote by Pat Callan, who said, "There tends to be a belief in the academy that Democrats treat higher education better than Republicans, but such perceptions don't reflect what happens in the real world of politics." And the reason I put that up there is our finding was, against some other literature, that showed that there were actually increased appropriations associated with Republican governors. And I've had conversations with some people about this, and I guess this is up for debate, but some have actually said, well, you know, in Wisconsin, Tommy Thompson, maybe compared to what we have now, he wasn't all that bad in terms of supporting higher education, especially the Madison campus. And again, a lot of it had to do with the economic development, the BioStar, all of this type of work. And I think in those states where they use workforce as sort of a rationale for funding, maybe this is the case. So I think, you know, it's interesting in the sense of does it really matter? Is it the partisan piece? Maybe we have to pull Jay Stampin's honeybee coalitions piece to really look a little more clearly at who are these people. I have till two or something?
Keep going.
Okay, good. and then the other resource dependency, this was very important. So the places that were well modeled showed that these competitive factors were very important. So across the board, you saw the importance of this financial piece of support for K-12, healthcare, and corrections. And also, remember we talked about the court-mandated reform? that basically what was saying is these other priorities crowded out higher education in these states in terms of what was left for state support, and these other places had more support. So this was an important piece in the model. And then finally, some of the findings from the cultural perspectives is that we learned that there were increased appropriations, again, with this presidential voter election. So that would imply that states that are more progressive, as defined in terms of civic engagement and voting, were more likely to support higher education. And then also that there was increased appropriations with numbers of public institutions and per capita income. So the idea is that wealthy states that have historically supported higher education will continue to do so, according to this data anyway. So some of the implications and observations, and we still have some work to do on this, but this idea of institutional factors overall, remember we looked at enrollment, land grant status, private grant support, a few of those, they really didn't show up as being mattering a lot compared to the state level variables. So one of the implications, the question is, do these state level variables really kind of trump the institutional level variables? So in other words, you could be a great lobbyist in one place and do everything you can, but the fact that your K-12 went under reform, all of these types of things, are you sort of a prisoner of that setup? I mean, it's an interesting question. Or did we just not capture the relevant institutional variables, which is very possible, and that's kind of leading to future research in this area. And when we look at the power of state culture, especially when Justin put together, you know, the analysis and the statistics, is this variability in public funding really relates to occurring between states rather than within. So the idea is that if you are a place like UW-Madison, you have more in common with these variables and how are things going to happen in terms of your own state versus a peer institution like Michigan or other Big Ten universities. So it's the idea that institutions are going to really be kind of the product of the culture that they're in, and it's very separate from those other state variables from other states. The other part of the power of state culture, and we talked about this differencing of data, which basically meant that we were able to subtract from year to year, is that we found just this relationship was very small, between 3% and 7%. And basically what that tells us is we had about 92, a large percentage of this variance really relates to Wildavsky's literature, and I think 62, saying that the best predictor of next year's support is correct. And what we might argue then is that this supports this enactment theory, saying decisions are driven by assumptions of how things have always been. So when you think about it, if you were historically a poorly supportive institution and you have incremental budgeting over time, it's not going to help you because you always started out poorly incrementally. Conversely, if you were a place that was supported very well, even though you might be doing dips, you're better off than everybody else because everybody's kind of moving in that direction. Again, it has to do with the cultural piece of that. So we're still learning more about that, but that was an important piece for us to consider. In terms of some of the limitations of this research, and we're thinking about future work, is that we had, I believe, a good set of data that was clean data. However, I laid out a pretty robust and ambitious theory of how this works, right? We didn't capture everything, okay? We still need to do some work in thinking about that aligns with these theoretical framework construction. And also, this is a relatively short time series, going back in a series of time. And for those of you who have used some of this database, we used iPEDS and some of the other national big databases to put this together. There are some limits to what you have that we all confess to at the end. But fortunately, the people reviewing your papers have the same limits with theirs, so everybody's kind of off the hook. But we do that looking back to 85, there are those limits. And again, as this big piece is not this single institutional level variable remained in the model. Again, the question again, you know, where do we go from here? Does that need more work? Or is it really the state that kind of rules all? So we're looking at that. And so this is setting up a qualitative analysis which is saying we generated a list of institutions by these residual values. So in other words, these residual values said that, okay, you had a certain level of predictability and state support for these institutions. There were some that were predicted very well. In fact, actually, Wisconsin was in that model. But there are some we don't really know why that didn't fit well. And some were getting more money than we expected based on what our model told us, and others were receiving less. So the idea is that we have a list of higher and lower than expected appropriations, again, by the three Carnegie classes. And let me show you this. I don't know if you, again, this is kind of a table here. But based on this model, is you have a series of institutions that the lower than expected, the higher than expected by Carnegie class. So what we see here are some interesting things that Virginia Commonwealth, UVA, Virginia State, there's something happening in Virginia that was not well captured by our model. I had the chance actually to talk to, he was here at Wiscape not too long ago, David Bredeman, who he's going to support, you know, I'm going to kind of follow up with some of this with these folks. And he said, well, there are very good reasons I think maybe this is happening. I'm going to kind of look into that a little bit more. And also Oregon was in here, University of Oregon, Eastern Oregon State. So again, they were not very fit very well. A couple other interesting observations is that the SUNY schools seem to not be fit well, but it was on the other end. So they got more money than we thought they would based on these different variables. On the other side, though, look at the CUNY schools. So there shows that within the state itself that there was some kind of disconnect between the SUNY and the CUNY of how these factors lay out. So we want to learn more about that. And other pieces down here I think are very interesting is UMass Amherst got lower than predicted appropriations, but the colleges in other colleges in Massachusetts that were master's colleges, other research ones, they actually received more money than you'd expect. And it's been I've been starting to roll out kind of these questions and making these calls to kind of get initial data. And there's some interesting things going on that might explain this. California, I'm going to have to turn to my friend King here and find out. I haven't even started to look at this. It seems very interesting, but you have a lot of California community colleges that were not well fit by this model. So the next step here is that I'm going to, with thanks from the Spencer Foundation, is to do now a multi-case study of some of those institutions in this model that were in the various categories. So I'm going to look through the rational, political, and cultural frames to say what's going on at these places that we miss these variables in this analysis. So then we can have a more robust database to do some more additional quantitative. So that's the idea, and I want to also thank again Wiscape for their support of this as well and in pursuing this project. So I guess the last thing that I would want to put on, and we have a few minutes, right?
Yes.
We're supposed to go to, is it two we're going to?
Well, King, what time is your flight leave? No, joking. You
okay.
Okay.
But I thought we could have a discussion about this and, you know, implications for Wisconsin. I've been thinking about this and, you know, kind of have some ideas about it, but I'd just like to, you know, hear what people have to say and get some feedback and things that we might improve as we put this together.
So that's it. Comments from the audience?
Sorry, despite your plea at the end, I have several questions about what you did. Why didn't you put education attainment in there? You would think that states who had a lot of college graduates would probably lean towards supporting public higher education.
I think we did have attainment in the sense of percentage of enrollments in these. I see what you're asking about the total number.
Important cultural variable.
Right, of how state, I don't know why we didn't have any.
Anyway, another question, completely different.
Uh-huh.
Going back to your comment about the new Carnegie classifications, you know, Carnegie 1 by the beach, what about proximity to the state capital?
You know, that's very interesting. No, I think there's something to be said about that. That was actually one I thought a little bit about. And the other one I thought about, I don't know how we do this, but thinking about percentage of alums that are in the legislature.
Right.
That's a big thing in Florida right now, is they say, well, these are all loaded up with University of Florida grads, and that's why these other places don't do very well. But you're right. I mean, there's maybe things like that that we wouldn't have thought about because they have more pressure. I like that. I'm going to...
You know, I don't know which way it would go, but I think it could be interesting.
Yeah, maybe it could actually be worse for them, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We
so proximity. What else did we miss? You know, you think that you go through this whole thing, and then sure enough, you have an economist saying, you missed this thing. That's good. We need to include that. Other issues that... So that would fit, yeah.
With Virginia and California, high military spending states, and being found and not fitting the model as well, to me that's not a surprise.
Okay. Military spending.
Right.
I haven't seen that in the literature yet, so if we find something, that would be very interesting. Go ahead.
One question, and this is pure ignorance based on how funding is done in New York and other places, but is it possible there's some... are the appropriations from the state legislature directly to institutions in some of those states, or are they to some kind of,
right.
Like in Wisconsin, you know, the appropriation is for the UW system, and then the money is kind of, you know, funneled into institutions. So there's perhaps an intervening level of fairness and evening out that might not be the case in other states?
Exactly, and that's what we're hoping to find, because you're right, there are... some through the UW model, and actually the SUNY schools, I've been kind of calling around, I've heard that they're a very unified system and that they go together to the legislature versus others. Because that whole governance piece didn't show up very well, but you're right, some have direct appropriations in Florida. It's kind of it's kind of a free-for-all in the sense of what people are, institutions are getting. But that's one of the things that we want to learn more about. And in the prior study, that really came out in the qualitative side of, remember Ohio State said, you know what, we're not in the system, so everybody in this state wants to be the flagship. And so you had legislators in Ohio that were saying, if you say that Ohio State's the flagship, those are fighting words here in Cincinnati. Okay, so you had, but I mean, they were very regional, strong, and they were fighting for money in that sense. So this SUNY piece, I think there's going to be some of that, but again, I have to kind of go in with the unbiased view and see what emerges. But I think that's very real possibility. So,
can you break your data on longitudinally? I mean, like since the 1990s.
Yeah, we haven't done that. Yeah, we haven't done, I mean, it's been just kind of the straight 20-year, but yeah, when you think about those different, you know, events and factors, how they've changed over time, that would be maybe another swipe at looking at these shorter-term consequences.
In the 1990s to now, you know, there's some people are starting to write about the rotten, we're living in a robber baron era, you know, and we're sort of like the robber baron period in the 1890s and on the turn of the century. So, where politics is, it affects politics, and then, you know, that affects everything else.
Right. You know, one of the interesting things is, because this data set, as I mentioned, sort of started with the early 90s. This was really 96 to 98. And what you saw was kind of snapshots of periods where things were a little different. For example, in the late 90s, Georgia showed up great. And remember who was in office?
Yeah.
Zell Miller, pro-higher ed, right?
Ah!
Right, challenge somebody to do a duel. No, is he doing that? No, but you had very, you had some things going on politically, and I think one of the useful feedback from some anonymous reviewers were, were to give the idea of a longitudinal study because they said, you know what, great universities take a long time, you know, to rise or fall, and that this is a snapshot in time that you have to look over a long period of time. But it is interesting to see what things in a given time would really matter. So go ahead. I think he's got the mic. So.
Yeah, and then you can take it, I guess. Okay. On the California community colleges, your qualitative will be interesting to look at. There's probably an artifact of the funding formula because you're getting
right.
The small districts, I think, in one column, and some of the suburban districts that attract students from outside the district because of quality in the other, because they're large and high quality as opposed to some of the large urbans. So,
and there's an equalization fund there, too.
Yeah, so the funding
that kicks in, too.
Okay. That would be.
I see you've got 43 variables, and you've gotten a couple more. You'll sue me up to 50 or 60. The question is, have you run it just a correlation matrix? A lot of these things may be proxying for each other.
Yeah, we took out. We didn't actually use all 43. I mean, we came down and see what happened is, we kind of did the stepwise approach, a number of different approaches to pull them out. And then what we did is we just used the one that were most theoretically relevant. But you're right in terms of the correlation between some of these variables are close. And so we threw a lot of them out because of that. But initially, we started with this data set. We kind of tinkered around with that. And then we put it on the variable. Because ultimately, we'd like to even get less to explain, you know, the most. So if we could whittle them down to what the most important things are, who knows? Maybe it's this military thing and I'll retire after that. I'll cite you in the.
The trouble is that.
RealEconomy.com.
Okay.
The trouble is that you're throwing things out because of the way they measure things, and you put them in initially because you thought they were important, and now you say because they don't show up, we'll throw them out, and that's going to affect the relationship with your other variables.
Because what we did was a goodness of fit. Because part of what we were interested in was looking at. The variance side that would allow us to think about, what's left out there to do the qualitative side of this. So it wasn't sort of the hypothesis testing in the, you know, normal sense of the word. It was allow us to give us the best fit. So it was a different kind of method. But that's good feedback on that. Other, go ahead.
Another thing, the counterintuitive one, the Republican governors having an opposite and. Correlation. It turns out a lot of the Midwestern states had Republican governors in the 90s. In the 85 to 99 period, military spending was going down. In the Midwest, which has almost zero military spending, was booming like crazy compared to the rest of the country. And a lot of those Midwest governors just happened to be Republicans. So the income was flowing in and stuff, and so you might look at some of those other variables, the income variable, and again, of course, I'd say the military variable. RealEconomy.com if you want more information.
Okay.
Good.
Well, thank you.
Real economy. If there's one final question, I've got to run.
Oh, that's okay. I'll speak up. To what extent do you see this data being a strategic tool then for the institutions? Since a lot of these factors are external to their control.
Right.
And the other question I have for you, do you get a sense that the schools that are doing really well don't want the limelight on them?
That's funny.
For the schools that are not doing so well that really want the attention.
Well, I think those are the first part of it about the strategic piece is I think, you know, what this says on the preliminary end is that institutions are really kind of a product of their state culture and what the limitations are. So there's a limited amount of things you might be able to do as a lobbyist. So I think in terms of strategically, though, as this qualitative rolls out, hopefully what that will show us is that there are maybe a combination of rational, political, and symbolic activities that institutions are doing to actually, maybe not for the long term, but for a blip in time, will lead to greater support. I think about David Ward's initiative, the cluster hires, you know, some of the things that they did with matching money with the state. Some of those things you could argue are competitive strategies. They're symbolic in terms of we're going to serve the state better. They're political. They got coalitions around these ideas. So I think that's a diagnostic in the sense of that by looking at these other strategies, it might shed a little light on that. So I think the jury's still out on that a little bit. But I think, you know, on the front end, it shows this, I think, just the strength of your state culture. Now, the second question you had about the limelight, it's funny, when I presented this in the past of earlier version, you know, the first question that everybody has is what?
Where's my institution?
Exactly. I did this at this higher ed conference about 3 years ago with a different data set, a little different thing, and everybody came up to us, so we got to be at the bottom. We got to be at the bottom, you know. And I think that's, you know, what I would say to people who would think that Wisconsin, our current state of what we have, is it might get back to the idea of the cultural variables that we might be kind of losing support or whatever over a period of time, but we were never Mississippi. You see what I'm saying? So it's the idea that, you know, we may have started up here, but now are coming down to kind of the mean of where, so on the other end, for Mississippi and other, you see what I'm saying? So it's kind of this enactment theory of what it always has been. So even these cuts might be going up, but they're kind of above of other states. So I think that's an implication for Wisconsin when we see these wholesale cuts. It's there, but maybe what's the cultural transformation too? That's a whole nother.
Are you using fixed effects?
Yeah, yep. So.
Right. Well, thank you, David, very much.
Thank you.
And we'll take a small break, and we'll begin at 2:20 with President King Alexander's final presentation. And real quick before everyone leaves, I want to thank Beth because she has to go to a class. Beth was the organizer for this forum, so I want to thank Beth. And we'll be back at 2:20, so please come back. Thank you.